This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. Brooke Spector, your host. And we come to you every morning at 9 o'clock, or just after the news, actually. And today, I'm really pleased to have somebody who knows a great deal about the topic we're going to talk about, is a practitioner as well as an analyst of it. Gareth van Onselen, he has a master's from WITS in sociology, and he's worked for the Democratic Alliance in communications and political analysis. Then he's been a reporter, senior correspondent for the Sunday Times, and he worked at the Institute of Race Relations. And then he became CEO of the market research company Victory Research. He also writes a column every week for a newspaper for Business Live. And I like this description that he gives himself. He says he calls himself a liberal, a humanist, an author, but most of all, a political animal with a love for ideas, statistics, and argument. I think that's relevant because too often people hear about polls telling you this candidate or this party is ahead and that candidate or that party is behind without really understanding what, in fact, the science and the craft of polling and polling research is. And I thought none better than to ask Gareth to help me unpack this for you and to explain it and to give audience members a chance to get behind those numbers and understand what goes on when we talk about polling. It's a whole lot more than simply holding your finger up in the air and saying, aha, the wind is blowing to the north, northwest. And so therefore, magically, we have these numbers. Gareth, thank you for joining us. I'm pleased that you could take time.
Thanks, Brooks. Glad to be here.
I mean, I've heard you in various circumstances talk about polling data on electoral outcomes. But if you could sort of succinctly explain, what is it you do as a polling pollster, an opinion survey researcher? What is it? What is this craft?
Market research is essentially designed to be able to tell you within a degree of error what people or a particular constituency or market thinks about particular ideas, and to be able to do one of two things, either to quantify those opinions, in other words, to be able to tell you how many people hold that view and maybe some investigation into what the nature of that view is, and then qualitatively to be able to tell you why people hold the positions they do, what the reasons are that underpin their worldview or their expert opinion or whatever the case may be. And the combination of those two things are very powerful tools, especially if you're interested in determining a communications agenda or working out what people think of a brand. There's a whole element of market research, which is just consumer focused, which is obviously designed to tell companies what people think of their products and their offer. And then it also has an element which is very helpful for politics, insofar as it can tell you what people's political views are, what the support levels are for a party, and where those things are going over time. So it's basically an analytical tool that allows you to get a generally accurate assessment of what the world looks like when it comes to a particular view or opinion.
I mean, way back in the years before the invention of electricity, for reasons that confuse me still, I took classes in statistical analysis for social sciences and quantitative methods in that, which involved understanding and trying to interpret polling data and getting a sense for the two terms of the idea of the coefficient of reliability and the margin of error, both of which are crucial, it seems to me, even now, even though the tools have become more refined and more effective and more precise than back when I was first trying to understand this. But even so, it allows for a certain fudging going on. You know, you know, within 2 or 3 percentage points, there is a 95% chance our number is right, which I guess allows you to advise a politician or a party that this is the range of what we know, as opposed to this is precisely true. And that gets me to the question of why should we believe that the polling data that we see for an election or for the run-up to it in the campaign, why should we believe it's accurate? And How, in fact, do you get this data now?
Yeah, so there's, I mean, a long, complicated answer to that question. I mean, first of all, I don't think belief is the right word, and it's not necessarily the way you should approach this. I mean, it's the same way you would approach an opinion or a piece or a column. You should evaluate it based on its evidence, and if you find that evidence compelling, you should say that the findings are compelling, but I don't think it's a matter of belief. This is a fundamental problem in many societies, not just South Africa, because polling data is only really as powerful as the audience which understands and interprets it. And the truth is, in order to get the most value out of market research, there are a lot of caveats that you have to put in place on any particular finding. I mean, there's the margin of error, there's the confidence level, there's the size of your sample, there's how representative it is, whether you've done screening or not, what methodology you used. And frankly, even though we try to set all of these parameters out, it's not something that the marketplace, by which I mean the average person out there in newspapers, is necessarily interested in. There is a deep desire for the truth and for, you know, a fundamental finding and fact that can just be stated in a single sentence. And so it leads to a lot of stuff being badly reported, to being misinterpreted. And all of this is fueled by an environment with quite low education levels and quite a lot of hostility and conspiracy and distrust in opinion polls. And so you kind of got this environment where you're delivering a very sophisticated product that is quite limited in terms of what it can and can't tell you, very strong in some ways, weaker in other ways, but an environment which just wants a single sentence, a single truth, and a single fact that they can interpret as all-encompassing.
You spoke about the relatively low levels of education and sophistication among readers or listeners to polling data. Even in a society like the United States, which is in some ways overrun by polling at this point, you can't shake this, you can't turn around without running into polls about polls. There are people who crave finality and precision and preciseness. They're not comfortable with the idea that, you know, there's some fudge and gray area in all of this. What it means is that when you see a poll of an electoral race, it often ends up looking like you're looking at what I derisively call horse race politics. Who's ahead? Who's behind? What's the margin between the two of them? And that's it. That's a real thing, as opposed to the outcome of asking 1,500 people a bunch of questions.
Yes. So, I mean, a couple of things to say about that. One, I think that's true. Look, I mean, you can't blame society for its level of interest or its level of education when it comes to something like polling. But I think you can blame the media. And I mean, I think they have a responsibility to understand what they're reporting on and to be able to report on it properly and thoroughly. And the ability of our press to be able to report on polling is absolutely dire. Least of all, this deep desire to make every poll into a prediction, which, I mean, market research companies like ourselves and Ipsos have taken to writing in capital letters, I mean, as if you're talking to children, that this is not a prediction. And it doesn't matter. The poll is reported in the newspaper as this poll predicts this result, because they need that absolute certainty and drama to sell papers. And it really is frustrating. But, you know, society, I mean, the media more generally in other countries takes this stuff incredibly seriously. The regulations, the press ombuds regulations in the United Kingdom when it comes to reporting on polling, they are very stringent. You have to report the margin of error. You have to report the various methodological indicators that accompany a poll. And you have to be willing to show the journalists the raw data sets. I mean, and that's especially true of election periods where those regulations become very important. Here, it's a free play. I mean, I could run a Twitter poll and report that as a poll if I wanted here and say it predicts, you know, the EFF's going to get 87% in the election.
We're going to have to take a break for station identification and commercial messages, and we'll be right back. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector. Our guest today is Gareth Van Onselen, who is explaining and helping us understand the world, the magical world of polling and why it matters, and some of the pitfalls in understanding it and in explaining it. We'll be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and our guest today is Gareth Van Onselen, man who understands polling, its virtues, its limitations, and the way in which it can be abused and misused. And I think that's an important part of our conversation right now. And you, just before we took a break, you were explaining that in Britain, data set at the top says, this is not a prediction. Do not believe this as a guide to the future. And yet humanity wants to know what's going to happen. And I mean, the problem with polling, or the circumstances, maybe not the problem, is it's a snapshot of any particular moment in time. And that moment changes. And that takes us obviously to the question of tracking polls, which I know you've had a hand in. And tracking polls attempt to find a trend rather than simply quick snapshot. But maybe you could explain what a tracking poll is and why it's valuable.
Before I do that, that's a very important observation you make. One of the most valuable parts of polling and one of its great strengths is trends. And if you are willing to look past the desire for immediate truth and absolute certainty, you won't get those with trends either, but you'll get closer to it. And depending on how consistently, deeply you measure trends, I think you do get closer to a far more accurate read of what's happening out there than a one-off poll or snapshot. So I think the real value of polling lies in its ability to consistently be able to track certain key indicators. Now, methodologically, the best way to do that is a tracking poll. And the way they work is really like a lot of individual polls run very closely together and interlinked. So in an individual survey, what you would do, as you said, is take a snapshot of time. You would interview, say, 1,000 people. It would take you 2 weeks to do it, and you would produce a set of results, and they would tell you what those 1,000 people thought, more or less, within a margin of error during that period when you were in the field questioning them. What a tracking poll does is it runs at whatever frequency you want. At its highest frequency, it runs daily. You establish what's called a base sample. So in the same way as the other one, you do an individual survey to build up a base, a set of respondents. And then depending on how frequently and deeply you want to track that movement, let's say you go with daily, you would poll, say, an additional 200 people a day. The oldest 200 people in that base sample would drop out and be replaced by the newer sample. You'd work out the overall average for those indicators, and that would give you a daily dot. Next day, you'd poll another 200 people. Again, the 200 people at the oldest would drop out and be refreshed by the 200 newest. Take the average, new dot. And so that way you build up a kind of daily dot, as it were, and you can join them all and get a trend line over time, and it's very helpful and accurate. Its accuracy depends on how big your base sample is. It depends on how many people you are willing to interview a day to refresh it. The one that we chose would take 5 days to completely refresh the sample. That's called a 5-day moving average. But you could poll 500 people a day and have a 2-day moving average. And that's a very, very accurate poll, tracking poll. The problem with tracking polls is they are hugely expensive to run. And there are very few people that can afford to do them. I mean, they require a great deal of manpower to make the calls every day, of programming and coding and waiting to be able to produce a new data book every day. And so while they're very invaluable, they're very expensive and quite rare, at least in South Africa.
When I was in school, as I say, back when the mammoths were ruling the tundra, understanding was, and the way it was beaten into me, that you had to get a survey sample that was reasonably useful as a predictive device in understanding a population's opinion on something, 1,500 people was the bottom line. Otherwise, it just doesn't work because you too many variables get confused. And in America, at least, they got used to doing random stratified cluster samples. In other words, you divide up a voting territory into X number of districts, and in each one of those, you decide how many people from upper income, middle, lower income, or black people, white people, whatever's salient for you. And then you have to draw a certain number of people equivalent to that percentage until you get the right number of people answering your poll. Now, the problem in the U.S. was it used to rely almost entirely not on person-to-person, but on telephone calls. That changed enormously once the telephone stopped being a fixed wire appliance in most people's houses, and you could no longer draw the numbers and the names at random from a telephone directory, because people now had cell phones for which there is no directory. And so now you're reduced to making random dialing from this. Is this a problem here now?
So a couple of things in response to that. One, yes, what you're describing is called splitting the sample. And personally, I have an ethical problem with that. I don't think you should ever split the sample. I think you should always have a single frame sample. A single frame basically means you have the same methodology and access data for everyone in the sample, and everyone has an equal chance of being drawn in that sample. If you split the sample, which is common cause in America, and I don't understand why it's not a bigger problem in terms of coverage and criticism of it, you damage your ability. Yes. You damage your ability to be random, which you have to be, and your ability to be representative. But, you know, this is just common cause there. So, I mean, you then moved on to the different kinds of methodologies and sampling techniques. And that's, you know, in general terms, in international terms, what's happened in most markets, certainly most markets that are interested in polling, is people have moved from face to face, which is the most expensive because it's hugely labor intensive. You need people to go to an individual house to conduct an interview, to then to telephones, and now to online polling. In South Africa, we're a bit behind that. We don't yet have the penetration rates to be able to do good online polling. Well, that's not true. We do, actually. We don't have the technology to be able to do that properly yet. And there's still, we're kind of still shifting between face-to-face and phone interviews. So both are single frame. Face-to-face has its upsides and downsides, but is a very good, solid technique. I mean, we offer all three of these as a market research company. So, you know, it's not like we have a particular preference. Mostly clients go with what's, you know, will guarantee a certain representativity and cheaper. And the frame of reference people use for face-to-face is households. So households are your sampling point. And you randomly select households from a grid. And if no one's there, you move two to the right. There are a whole lot of different ways to secure that it's random. Phone samples, we're the only really research company in South Africa that I think uses cell phones in a way that can generate a representative sample. Because traditionally, people just don't have the numbers. So they rely on lists, which means you don't have a representative sample and not everyone can be included in the sample because the lists are predetermined. So, but if you take every single, because South Africa is quite small, if you take every single code and, you know, the phone, I forget the name of the company that oversees all of these mobile things, but they'll give you every code and you can use software to generate every potential number in South Africa and randomly draw from that. And, you know, cell phone penetration rates in South Africa are 280%. It's insane. We've got one of the best penetration rates in the world, which means, you know, every South African on average has access to three phones. And then you just use the cell phone as the sampling point, as a substitute for the household, and you can reach everywhere, deep rural KZN, I mean, you name it. So we think that's the best kind of polling methodology for political polling, but there's debate. Other research companies will say elsewise. I don't think the difference is fundamental, to be frank. And then there's online stuff, which we can't really do here, but it relies on smartphones. You sample in the same kind of way. But a lot of Western democracies almost use exclusively online now because it's the cheapest and easiest to do.
I'm going to have to take a station break and a commercial message, as we do every once in a while. This is Brooke Spector with The Deep Dive. And our guest today is Gareth Van Onselen, who knows his stuff about polling and survey research, which is why we're talking with him, because in case you haven't heard, South Africa's going to have an election this year, and polling and survey research is going to be a crucial part of that for the planning for almost every political party. We'll be right back after this message.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host. And our guest today is Gareth Van Onselen. He is the head of a company called Victory Research, among his many other talents. And he is one of the premier pollsters in South Africa. And we were doing all the discussions about the technique, the technology, the underlying layers of things that lead to polling. But of course, what people want to know is, what does it tell us? If you could generalize it a bit, what is the polling now telling us about South Africans, the South African electorate, as it thinks about or begins to think about the election? Is there a climate of uncertainty, or have people already picked their horse to run with? and they're not going to change, or is everything in a state of flux?
I mean, one of the things I'd like to refer back to was a point you made a bit earlier about, you know, this kind of horse race approach to local politics. And, you know, it only seems like a couple of questions are asked in a lot of these surveys. A lot of clients, a lot of our clients, actually ask very comprehensive surveys, you know, 20-minute surveys with a lot of questions and a lot of deep data about the electorate. They don't release that stuff publicly, though. They use it for their own purposes. And it's unfortunate. That's unfortunate because, I mean, there's some really interesting stuff behind the scenes as to, you know, what these parties' brands are constructed on, what their kind of pull and push messages are, leader favorability, you know, policy testing, that kind of stuff, which is, I mean, it's very helpful in fleshing out the background to the one or two questions you see typically in the media, which are what's party political support at. So, and that's important. I mean, I can't tell you that stuff because it's obviously our clients keep it confidential, but, and the data belongs to them, not us. But it's unfortunate because a lot of these numbers need that kind of context and fleshing out to fully understand and to be able to answer your question. But given what I have at my disposal, I can say the following. So there's uncertainty about several big things in South Africa, and there's certainty about several big things. The uncertainty is the ANC going to drop below 50% nationally? Is it going to drop below 50% in KZN? And is it going to drop below 50% in Gauteng, in that order? So I would say the biggest uncertainty is nationally, second KZN, third Gauteng. I think it's the most certain they'll drop under 50 there. And those are interesting questions from, I don't know, for me, from a metaphorical point of view. You know, it's big news if the ANC drops below 50%. It's been 30 years. This is a fundamental, possibly tipping point in the life of a very big, grand revolutionary movement in South Africa. As far as raw power goes, it tells us, I think, with more certainty that it's going to be incredibly difficult to get the ANC or like-minded parties out of national power. In other words, even if the ANC falls below 50%, the odds are it'll be able to form a coalition before any opposition parties are. That is a similar situation in Gauteng, less in KwaZulu-Natal, a big Gauteng. And it tells us that, you know, the combined opposition is not growing at a fundamental rate. There's some small progress among some parties here and there, but that seems to be fracturing at the same rate that the ANC is fracturing. And both these strands, the kind of ANC worldview and the opposition worldview, seem more at odds with each other than they do, or than they are able to eat into the other strand. Those are some of the big takeaways I would say.
I was going to ask you from that then this the seemingly fissiparious tendency now for political parties that everybody and his brother or sister-in-law wants to have a political party, six persons and a mimeograph or a photocopy machine and an internet connection constitutes a political party now. I lost count of the number of parties that actually think they're contesting some election, but is this actually going to have a demonstrably important effect, or are these all going to be pushed to the margins by the time people count all the ballots? I mean, in general picture, I realize, again, I'm not trying to pin you down to predictions about the future.
Yeah, it's very hard to determine. I mean, it can be done. It's just not many people or no one that I know have done it in any powerful way to determine what the effect of this fracturing of the vote. Because on the one hand, it's irrelevant in terms of seats won, which at the end of the day determines the power in any legislature or parliament. That's done in a formula. It doesn't matter how many parties contest on the national ballot. The formula includes basically the top 97% and only 3% of those votes, whether that comprises 50 parties or two parties, will fall away. So in that sense, you get into the top 97, you'll get a seat in parliament, and it's always been thus. Where it does matter is outside of seats won and the ability of these smaller parties collectively to be able to eat away at one of those two strands, either the kind of ANC worldview or the opposition worldview. And I think initially there were few of these things on either side. You know, back in the day, there was the UDM and COPE and stuff like that and the EFF. And the opposition had, you know, good and a hung for a while. But, I mean, as you alluded to, in the last 10 years, the stuff has just exploded. And so instead of one or two kind of slightly significant bites being taken out of the likes of the DA and the ANC, you now have 1,000 small bites. And that does affect your ability to get a substantial percentage. It might not affect your ability to get the same number of seats, but your ability to consolidate the electorate on either side is made much more difficult, not just because votes get scattered at a wide range, but resource-wise. I mean, these parties now, and it costs a lot to be able to fight political battles on more than one front and have different messages and different approaches to different parties eating away at you. It really detracts from your ability to be able to focus on the core problem. And I think you're seeing that everywhere.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector. My guest is Gareth von Onselen, and we'll be right back after this message.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. Brooke Spector, your host every Friday morning, and my guest today, Gareth von Onselen. You may have thought that you tuned into a tutorial on polling and statistical methodologies, but we thought it was really important for listeners to get behind the scene, behind the sort of the simple version of polling data that we see, so-and-so is ahead, so-and-so is behind, and understand how this works and why it matters. And I could think of nobody better, in fact, than asking Gareth to join us for today. And while just before we took a break, we were talking about the way in which the new collection of small parties are beginning to have or will have an effect on the way the voting goes or the outcome arrives in the upcoming election. And I stopped you just before you got to your conclusion about how that is going to play out. Are most of these small parties going to vanish beneath the waves, not make the cutoff, or are many of them going to somehow manage to find a resonance with audience, with potential voters?
Yeah, well, the problem with the phrase small parties is there's kind of a popular understanding, which is sort of, you know, those parties that fall, they're around the 3% and lower range in the National Assembly. And then there's the full definition of smaller parties, which is, you know, around 500 parties are standing this election, and every 99% of them are small parties or regional parties or provincial parties. And so I think 99% of them will vanish without a retrace. Amongst the more common conception of small parties, no, there's some of them that seem to have a small but consistent market, you know, the likes of the Freedom Front and the ACDP and other parties that have a kind of niche market that will sort of always be there to one degree or another on the fringes. As for the newer, more substantial smaller parties, the likes of Rise Mzansi and Action South Africa, yeah, those have some potential to get in there amongst the thick of it when it comes to the smaller parties, to get sort of a percent or three. How long they last, well, we'll have to see. They don't have a good record, these kind of new prominent parties sort of led by charismatic leaders that arrive on the scene. In the past, a lot of them have sort of faded away quite quickly in 10 or 5 years. It's hard to say. It depends what your internal organization and structure is like, what your market is like, what your ability to grow is like. A lot of those smaller parties don't think beyond the election they're contesting. And I think some of these other ones do. And yeah, there's every prospect of them lasting. Whether they'll ever get really big, I don't know. But yeah, I would suspect the likes of Rise Mzansi and Action South Africa will certainly last for a few election cycles to come.
Judging from what I've seen around the world, for smaller parties, it really depends on whether they find an issue or a collection of related issues that find a real resonance with the population or with some portion of the population, such that they can convert that feeling into electoral success. And I'm thinking, in particular, in European terms, of green parties, which came from nothing to become actual electoral forces in some countries and members of government, in some of them. And in Germany, for example, the newer party, AfD, part of a a wave of small right-wing parties in some countries, populist right-wing parties that weren't there two, three election cycles ago and now also are likely to achieve electoral success sufficient to be in coalition governments somewhere. Now, that brings me to the question that we haven't talked about and which political scientists pay attention to in particular, and that's turnout. And I think a lot of scenario planners for the election, they always end up with models that talk about high turnout, normal turnout, low turnout, the way it affects voting patterns or results. Is this something that you pay a lot of attention to, this question of turnout?
Yes. So, I mean, it's fundamentally important and absolutely critical to any political poll that you generate turnout models. And the reason for that is simple, is, I mean, if I'm just interviewing registered voters, and any serious political poll should only, which is interested in electoral outcomes, should only poll registered voters, because on election day, they're the only people whose opinion matter. You have people in the sample who are not registered, they're going to skew your results because whatever they think is irrelevant on election day. So what you need to be able to do is, I mean, if you poll, let's say, 1,000 registered voters, and you get your results from that poll, and it says, well, the ANC is on 60%. Well, the problem with that is that result assumes every single person in your sample is going to vote on election day. And in turn, every single registered voter in South Africa is going to vote on election day. And that's just never true. So what's called the baseline support that comes out of these polls, which is often reported on in the press as if that's the actual number, is just not a real indication of where this party support is, because only a certain number of those people are going to vote on election day. So the trick is to be able to develop a methodology to identify which people in your sample are representatives of those people who are actually going to vote on election day, to take those people in the sample who are unlikely to vote out of it, and then see what the numbers are. And in order to do that, you need to do turnout modeling, it's called. And you layer the questionnaire with a series, usually 6 or 7 questions, which are designed to gauge how probable it is that any one respondent in the poll is actually going to vote. And you use those questions set at different levels to pull different numbers of people out of the pool. So, you know, if you generate, you never know what the exact percentage will be because it depends on how many people you pull out. But let's say, for example, a number of people suggest they're more than likely to vote, and you categorize that as a low turnout scenario or a high turnout scenario. You pull those people out, you get a percentage of people left, you work up the numbers. If you use 5 questions, and you get a low turnout scenario, you pull those people out of the sorry, I'm getting inundated by calls here. You pull those people out of the sample, you get a high turnout scenario, and yeah, you see what that says.
In the U.S., pollsters often work on the assumption that you're not just asking whether someone is registered to vote or whether they're likely to vote, but the payoff question is, did you vote in the last election? Now, of course, that's a problem with first-time voters because they couldn't vote in the last election because they weren't eligible yet. And so you have to work out a methodology to get around that problem. But turnout is always affected by, at least in some countries, by weather. If there's a blizzard, people stay home. If it's raining cats and dogs, people stay home.
Yeah, these turnout, that's why they're called models. They're effectively scenarios. They're not an attempt to predict what turnout is. I mean, a turnout question in the same way as any question in a poll will give you an idea of people who are going to behave a certain way or have a certain attitude within a margin of error. And that assumes good weather, normal voting procedures, and a happy day. I mean, you can put a question in a poll. If it rains, are you going to go vote? Not a bad question. As a turnout kind of model question, and see what that does and generate a scenario for that. But at the end of the day, these are, you know, just helpful trends and general assumptions to make about the direction in which stuff is going. And you can get as sophisticated or unsophisticated as you want, depending on the kinds and how many questions you ask on that front.
We're going to take another station break, and we're speaking with Gareth von Onselen, master poll maker, head of Victory Research, and we've been trying to provide our audience with a quick master's degree in polling technology and polling ideas so that you can interpret electoral data with much more expertise than your neighbor. And that's the point of this morning's tutorial. I'm Brooke Spector. This is The Deep Dive, and we'll be right back after this message.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host, and my guest is Gareth von Onselen, master pollmaker, and helping us understand the magic and the science behind all this, as well as the artistry in it, because it requires some delicate dancing around things you cannot predict necessarily. They're guesses. They're educated guesses, but they're guesses. I sort of want to couple of other things I want to ask you before we go. Given what you know now, and given the way you've seen the polling take place in this country, should we be looking at starkly different results nationally versus provincially, as the two elections are taking place?
Well, yes. I mean, the results will vary wildly by a lot of provinces. I mean, obviously, you know, the DA is dominant in the Western Cape. The ANC's got serious and fundamental problems in Gauteng. The IFP is a force in Gauteng that it's not in KZN, that it's not in other parts of the country. Yeah, I think there'll be quite a lot of variety provincially. Nationally, yeah, I suspect everyone will do, if we put the ANC aside for a moment, more or less in line with the way they've been doing in the past. So parties like the EFF, the DA, the IFP, maybe even the Freedom Front Plus to a degree will grow sort of in line with the way they grew in the past. The fundamental changes nationally will be MK, is Jacob Zuma's new party, and what it's capable of doing nationally. But I think it does have some serious potential. And the ANC's decline. You know, the ANC can decline without necessarily benefiting other parties insofar as its voters just stay away in massive numbers. And that's certainly a trend that seems to be increasing over time. So the ANC's decline, and this is the big thing we don't know. Is the ANC's decline steady or is it exponential? If it is steady, then 50% becomes difficult but easier for it to get. If it is exponential, then it definitely falls below 50%. The last local government election suggests it's exponential, but, and this is something people don't talk about enough, that election was profoundly affected by COVID. I think it had a deep impact on turnout. And a lot of people don't, I mean, local government elections usually have poor turnout, but I think this was exacerbated by COVID, and we'd just come out of stay-at-home regulations. And I think it had a big impact. And, you know, we're now well out of that, and people care more about national elections. So it might not drop as much as people think. I think it will still drop, but not as much.
I mean, the old theory, political scientists, especially ones studying Africa, have always talked about liberation parties get a generation to convert themselves from liberation parties to, quote-unquote, normal political parties. The ANC is obviously now into its third decade of, and this transformation seems not entirely finished. Let's put it that way. Some days they appear to be a normal quote unquote party, and some days they want to embrace history much more, liberation language much more than in other days. Does that rule really apply, and should we bank on something like that, or is that really just something we're deriving from a couple of experiences that may not necessarily matter?
No, I think that's a very important observation, and my take is that the ANC has always been half in, half out, half a sort of traditional democratic party, half a revolutionary movement, and I don't think its attitude has changed much over 30 years. I think it's always been half in, half out. I think it can't do either part properly, which is a large contributing factor to its kind of internal chaos. It can't balance the demands of a constitutional democracy, especially when it comes to things like accountability and transparency and federalism and all the other demands of a constitution, with the idea that it is the voice of the people, quote unquote, and this sort of, you know, all-powerful hegemonic force there to deliver one set of ideals. So, yeah, and I think that, but, you know, South Africa is bizarre on that front of a number of levels. I mean, the EFF is ostensibly, and if you read their documents and listen to their leader, a revolutionary party. Now, I don't know of many revolutionary parties that, you know, appear on the red carpet at Sona for pictures. I mean, certainly not the kind of thing Stalin or Mao would have approved of. So they also constantly want to overthrow the state, but also be part of the state and benefit from its largesse. So you have these kind of contradictions everywhere in South Africa. And it's one of the things we're grappling with as a country. I think we are moving more towards constitutionalism. I mean, if I can go on a bit, the way in which people conceived accountability 10 or 15 years ago was fundamentally the ANC's way of conceiving of accountability, which was, I need only explain something and then I have accounted for it. Whereas accountability in a traditional kind of constitutional sense has two elements. You have to explain something, and depending on the veracity and nature of your explanation, there either are or aren't consequences. And I think society has moved much closer now to recognizing and understanding that there must be consequences attached to accountability. I think that value has shifted, and people now talk about accountability in terms of something must happen. You can't just explain what happened. I remember when there was load shedding the first time in 2007, and Mbeki got before Parliament, explained how government messed stuff up, and there was a press conference afterwards. And one of the journalists said to him, well, where's the accountability? And he said, well, there's just been accountability. I just explained to Parliament what happened. And you couldn't get away with that today.
Gareth, we only have a couple of minutes left, and I wanted, is there something that we haven't mentioned or asked you about which it would be a dramatic oversight if we didn't at least touch on it?
Wow. Lots of stuff that we haven't talked about. But
you got about 3 minutes.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think the bottom line for polling is in South Africa is it requires quite a bit of work on the person, on the part of the person who's reading it and trying to interpret it. If you take that work and take that time and make an effort to understand what it can and can't tell you, it can deliver tremendous value. If you don't take that time and you demand only a top line figure that you can believe is fundamentally true for now and the future, you will not get value out of it. And I think it's the media's job to teach people that the stuff is a lot like the economy. You need to concentrate on it and you need to understand the parameters of what you're talking about in order to get value out of it. And that's the big challenge that, you know, as a market research company, we face with the public press and public understanding.
Yeah, I'm glad you did that. I'm glad you pointed to the media as an interpreter, an explainer, and a clarifier. That was sort of in the back of my mind, at least for this conversation, that we really wanted to get into the interstices of this business rather than simply horse race politics and who's up and who's down and that kind of thing. And I really appreciate your being able to do this. I hope we can call upon you again once the election has taken place to help us interpret in a deep sense what just happened. I look forward to being able to.
Great. Thank you, Brooks. That would be wonderful.
This has been another Deep Dive with Brooks Spector, your host, but my guest today, Gareth Onselin, pollmaster, head of Victory Research, and as he says of himself, a liberal, a humanist, and an author, and a political animal with a love for ideas, statistics, and argument. We haven't had any arguments, but we've got lots of insights about ideas and statistics, and I really appreciate your time. We'll be back again next week with another guest on the Deep Dive.